You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. Today's show is brought to you by Ducks Unlimited, the leading conservation group for restoring habitat for waterfowl and all things wild to benefit the nation's hunters. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Dreeslein. Thrilled to be with you for the next 1 hour. We'll have Les Meister at the end of the show. In between, we will talk with Charlotte Roy from the Minnesota DNR about the latest rough grouse and sharp-tailed grouse numbers. Pretty good outlook for fall. Pete Fisher will also join us. We'll talk summer dog training, getting to be that time of year. Going to kick it off now, though, with Tim Spielman. Tim, welcome. Good to see you. And like I say, I don't want to spend a lot of time on the grouse stuff since I'm going to talk to Charlotte. But really, really good-looking report. What, the highest rough grouse numbers in like 52 years?
Yeah, it's definitely good news. There's always the caveat that it doesn't mean the fall hunting is going to be great, or you know, reflective of what the survey is. But we see that every year. I mean, it's always it's said after every or during every survey report in every survey report. But yeah, last year it wasn't terribly long ago, but I remember hearing from a lot of folks about the great grouse hunting. So I'm kind of curious to see what the harvest was based on that other survey that we haven't seen yet, the small game hunter survey.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, if it was great last year and we've got positive feedback from this this drumming survey in the rough grouse realm anyway, it bodes well for fall.
Yeah. So that we know the birds came out of winter in good shape. The one thing that this survey wouldn't necessarily reflect is what all this rain means for young rough grouse. And like I say, maybe we'll get Charlotte's take on that in our next segment. We do know that all this rain, we've been talking about it, how it doesn't necessarily bode well for pheasant chicks and wild turkeys. And Tori McCormick had a really good story, a well-reported story, how about we say that? Some of what he had in there wasn't real optimistic. He talked about Scott Romhelt down in southwestern Minnesota, and Scott says he's not seen a lot of pheasant chicks running around just yet.
Yeah, well, I got the impression that the back roads he takes to his work in New Ulm were impassable for a while. So yeah. maybe he'll see more when he's able to drive those roads again. And I'm thinking that's probably now. I think most of that's subsided. There was mention of ditch habitat, and I don't know, part of me thinks it's, you take whatever habitat you can get, but if pheasants are reduced to having enough nests in ditches that when they get flooded, it's going to affect the overall population, it's not a great state of affairs.
The birds, again, we feel pretty confident, came through winter in good shape. There should be a lot of birds from the past couple years. It's just going to reflect, will there be young of the year birds out there this fall, right?
Yeah, and, you know, it's all about timing, and we'll find out a lot come August when the roadside counts occur. But, gosh, if it seems to me that a lot of the heaviest rain came after the peak time of hatch. And if that's the case, as Tori reported, then you won't have hens re-nesting, right? Isn't that the impression you got?
Right. Good point. Yeah.
So that causes some concern for me. But on the other hand, maybe some did. And like Scott said, they're resilient birds. And if they can re-nest, they will. It wouldn't be the first time that we've seen really, really young roosters come the pheasant opener, if that is in fact the case.
It might not be good this year, but, you know, you get another mild winter and maybe get back to a normal amount of precipitation in 2025. I know we're looking a long ways out. Like you say, they are resilient and they could bounce back. But to be determined on on all these species, right? We'll find out with the ruffed grouse when the dogs actually start flushing them this fall. And like you say, those roadside counts for pheasants will be really important here. Not too far out, huh? We'll be reporting the results of that, probably 6-7 weeks?
Yeah, I think it's usually mid to late August, I believe. I think the survey takes place the first couple of weeks of August, mm-hmm. I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll all be holding our breath for that one, more so than usual.
Tim, did you see the Star Tribune story of the two guys that kayaked through flooded Valley Fair?
No.
I thought that was pretty interesting. It's not like they were just went out and they were like, well, it's public water. but they described it as apocalyptic.
Oh boy!
You know, kayaking among the flooded roller coasters. I thought that was thought that was kind of interesting. Inside this week's newspaper, we talked last week, Tim, a little bit about this record crappie, this guy who had broke the crappie record back to back. Well, then it's kind of funny, Tim. We got this new staff writer here, Natalie Ryder, and I was telling her about the record fish thing and what had happened on Monday morning. And then Monday afternoon, we get the press release with nine new state records. As you and I have discussed, the DNR revamped its record fish program. So you got a bunch of unoccupied certified records, and people are filling them quickly. And I got to think they're going to just keep topping them for a while until you get a really big outlier, right? That blows everything out of the water. You had an upbeat text, I think, to me Monday night, Tim, where you said something along the lines of, well, it's an opportunity for people, a lot of people, to get their names, their 15 minutes sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. but if I had a record fish, I'd be pretty proud of it. I don't care what kind of record it is.
Sure. And it's an opportunity for folks to probably go out and say, okay, well, this is the status of this record, and especially for maybe some outlying fish like Moon Eye. And, go find some prime Moon Eye water, and maybe you could turn around and break that record. Listen to Outdoor News Radio, Rob Driesine with Tim Spielman, kicking off this week's broadcast. Tim, a little item I was talking to Dean Bortz about, I thought I'd get your quick take on. Did you realize that the Wisconsin DNR does not have a leader, and they haven't had a leader since Adam Payne resigned from the DNR secretary post? That's their equivalent of a DNR commissioner over here. Adam Payne quit that job, I think, effective November 1 of last year. So they're going on 9 months without having a DNR secretary.
Maybe it means we don't need a DNR leader or commissioner.
Yeah, it's a big salary, huh? Is that role necessary? I guess you could have that discussion.
Sorry, Sarah, but if we're looking to make cuts, you're not above it.
Now, Dean was telling me that, morale in the agency isn't real good, and it feels a little bit rudderless, right, when you don't have, that leader mm-hmm. running around representing the agency and kind of laying out the vision thing, which, love or hate the vision, I think Sarah's pretty good at that.
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, then, who, with the real tough calls, who signs off on things? I mean, aren't there certain things that the secretary there would have to give final approval to, things like that? Did they just pass that on to Governor Evers there?
Well, there's a deputy secretary, and I forget his name, but presumably that person is kind of the acting secretary, I don't know, signing off on some of those items. And typically, I mean, that's kind of how it works over here too, right, Tim? The deputy is a bit of the enforcer at the agency, and the commissioner, I think, tends to be more of the, like I said, the vision person. But
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I actually had not realized that. That's it's a pretty significant amount of time to be going without someone in a key position like that.
And Tim, one other item regarding flooding. I really like the commentary from Matt Dahl. Was it Minnesota Environmental Partnership? Saying some things that need to be said. That one reason these rivers got as high as quickly as they did was because of all the tile lines, drain tile lines we got out there. And I don't know how many miles of tile lines are in Minnesota, Tim. It's got to be tens of thousands pretty easily.
Yeah, and considering the fact that, like we talked about when I saw ag fields that were still holding water, that I'm guessing were as many as I saw. I thought a lot of these have got to be tiled, but it's just not able to keep up. And Tori McCormick and I have been talking about it for a while, that water just rushes off the landscape now. We're talking areas where there used to be tons and tons of wetlands that would hold the water and give it time to sink in, saturate the ground. And now it goes off the land and it hits ditches, it hits tile lines, and it hits rivers and streams in a matter of no time. So, you know, you reap what you sow.
You know, Tim, I went out in an aerial flight with a Fish and Wildlife Service guy and a couple other journalists early in my career here at Outdoor News. Maybe it was the Red River flooding year or something like that. And it was a flood year. It was later in the year. I know that Red River thing was, of course, in the spring, but it was a wet year, probably like this one. And from the air, you could just see where the water wanted to be because you could see the corn was all yellow, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it was flooded. And you could just see from the landscape where the water wanted to be. And it can't normally be there anymore because of the draining, and you know, that's one reason we don't have the ducks, we don't have as many pheasants as we would like, but we feed the world, so I guess there's that.
Well, there are a lot of cities along rivers that we're probably not happy about the way we've progressed in land use practices without proper consideration for the effects of mm-hmm. what we do. So
yeah, cities and small towns alike. There's, you know, some small towns in Minnesota mm-hmm. got hit pretty hard this summer.
Yep.
Well, hey, Tim, good stuff as usual. We will check back with you next week. Stay cool, I guess we'll say. It looks like a pretty warm forecast coming.
Yeah, I will certainly try. Thank you.
All right, that was Tim Spielman. Appreciate him joining us. Stick around. We'll chat with Charlotte Roy from the Minnesota DNR. We'll talk to her a little bit about this very upbeat report for rough grouse, and not even all that bad for a sharp-tail grouse in northwestern Minnesota. When we return, this is Outdoor News Radio.
Hunting season will be here before you know it, and it's time to get ready for your next adventure with the OnX Hunt app. Whether you're traveling in search of roosters, elk, waterfowl, or looking to score on a whitetail close to home, OnX Hunt can help you be more successful this season. Route, plan, and navigate with private and public land boundaries, recent imagery, offline maps, and Minnesota-specific hunt layers. Download the Hunt app on the App Store or Google Play and join the millions of hunters that trust OnX Hunt.
Minnesota's largest outdoor event returns for its 43rd year, Game Fair. Check out dozens of hunting, fishing, and dog training seminars. Visitors can see more than 300 exhibitors, plus enjoy games for dogs and youth. Test the latest equipment and enjoy the world-famous duck and goose calling contest. Game Fair runs 2 weekends, rain or shine, August 9th, 10th, and 11th, and August 16th, 17th, and 18th at the Armstrong Ranch in Ramsey. See details at gamefair.com.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
Since 1967, generations of Minnesota sportsmen have trusted Outdoor News to keep them up to date with the latest news, pro tips, features, fishing reports, gear reviews, and more. For less than a buck per week, you can carry on the tradition and join thousands of Minnesota sportsmen by subscribing to Outdoor News. Whether you prefer a printed copy in your mailbox each week or the convenience of up-to-the-minute news on your smartphone or computer, we've got you covered. Subscribe today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Sulfide ore copper mining threatens the health of the nation's most popular wilderness, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, right here in Minnesota. You can help keep the BWCA clean. Join Sportsmen for the Boundary Waters. Pledge to protect the integrity of this incredible wilderness and its watersheds for hunting and fishing, for clean water, and for future generations. Join other hunters and anglers in demanding permanent protection of this national treasure. Visit sportsmenbwca.org to learn more about the threats to the Boundary Waters.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline is with you for another segment. I hope you like the broadcast. If you do, please check us out online at outdoornews.com. You can subscribe to the print or digital versions there, or you can call us at 800-535-5191. We will also have a booth out at Game Fair and State Fair, which are approaching rapidly, believe it or not, as summer trudges on. Hey, we got a really upbeat press release from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources last week about the status of rough grouse in Minnesota. I think it's pretty awesome. It's, you know, we don't always get a ton of good news these days, and we're getting really good rough grouse reports going into this fall. Here to talk to us about that is Charlotte Roy. She's the Grouse Project Leader with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and she joins us now. Charlotte, thanks so much for carving out some time. Rough grouse populations, I guess, what, similar to last year, which was a good year. Is that the quick summary?
Yes. Last year was a very good year for most hunters. And I think that all looks to be on good track right now, especially in the core of rough grouse range. There's some differences among the regions in terms of how counts compare to last year. But in the core of rough grouse range in the northeast part of the state, they are high again this year.
So the rough grouse population follows kind of this 10-year cycle. And we had, what, a low point in the cycle in 2021 that was not quite as low as some of our previous lows, followed by what you folks are describing from your drumming counts this spring as the highest peak since 1972. The spring drumming counts were the highest levels we had seen in 52 years. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's not entirely clear how that's manifesting. We do know that we've had some really favorable summer conditions in the last few years, some mild winters and good snow roosting conditions preceding that. And so, you know, all of these things may be contributing to these strong numbers in the Northeast. Another potential contributing factor is that we've had a lot of turnover of staff with retiring folks and new staff coming in. And so those fresh new ears may be detecting a few more grouse than some of the previous observers were detecting. So it could be a combination of different things, but by all accounts, last fall, the numbers were pretty good, and they were good the spring before that as well. So hopefully things are looking good. We had some heavy rainfall this spring and summer throughout much of this region. I was a little concerned that that might, you know, be problematic for chick survival, but so far I'm hearing some pretty decent reports about brood surveys so far. So I'm crossing my fingers, but you never know.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah, a lot of variables from the ears on our volunteer counters to the winter snow levels to the drought we had for a couple of years, which you're saying was actually pretty good for grouse. For starters, when do the drumming counts take place? Are they like March, April, May, that time frame?
They're usually conducted in April and May before the birds even begin nesting. So our drumming surveys are reflecting the number of drumming males in the population. And so it's an index of basically how many birds are in the breeding population this spring. It is obviously not reflecting production of young because that occurs much later. So there's this gap between our drumming surveys and our fall hunting season that includes, you know, the nesting period and the brood rearing period. And what hunters are seeing in the fall is actually reflecting all of those things. So how many birds are breeding, as well as how many nests hatch and how many chicks survive to the fall. So lots of factors go in there, and that drumming survey in the spring doesn't necessarily capture all of that.
Okay, so I want to circle back on several points. First of all, we may have some listeners out there saying, drumming, what is she talking about? This is like wild turkey strutting behavior. You know, all these big game birds, they do all these bizarre breeding season rituals, you might say, whether it's prairie chickens out in western Minnesota or wild turkeys in the forest, or in the case of rough grouse, they do this drumming. They make that thump, 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 thump sound, and that's establishing territories. They're breeding territory, correct? And so you've got volunteers out there listening for this drumming behavior and counting the amount of drums that they hear, and then it's an index that's been going on. How long has the DNR been doing the drumming survey?
For a very long time. Well into, I mean, we have in the report, we report all the way back to the 80s, but the survey actually started in 1949.
Sure. So we've been doing this a long time. So that's how we've built this index, right?
Yes, that's how we built the index. And it cycles, like you mentioned, according to approximately 10-year cycle.
And that's a whole other question, is what causes that 10-year cycle in rough grouse? So there's a number of theories, aren't there, Charlotte?
Yes, there's quite a few different hypotheses to explain it. I think the one that has gotten the most support recently is related to climate, actually, because grouse cycle in the northern part of their range in the northern latitudes, but in where they occur further south, they don't cycle. And so most of the data collected to date are supporting that climate is really playing a role in that cycle, and that climate change could potentially affect how that manifests.
I've heard other factors like goshawks. I've heard, the propensity of and the availability of food like aspen buds, winters, all sorts of different things. Bottom line, you have this cycle, and right now we're at the peak of the cycle, which is good news if you're a grouse hunter going out this fall. You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline chatting with Charlotte Roy from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources about the latest rough grouse drumming survey from this past spring that shows a lot of birds, at least going into this summer, which bodes well for this fall. All right, now let's talk about this weather thing and the gaps that you mentioned, Charlotte. I've talked quite a bit on this show in recent months about one reason maybe we had such a great wild turkey harvest is because there's a lot of wild turkeys out there is because of the drought, and that dry conditions are actually good in the spring for a lot of these game birds, pheasants, wild turkeys, and maybe even rough grouse. Rain isn't necessarily good for these birds when they're little and they're fluffy chicks, and that down gets all wet, they can get cold and they can die. And you can lose part or all of a year class of birds as a result of a lot of rain. Well, we've had a lot of rain since this survey. So are there any concerns that, we had a lot of drumming behavior, a lot of breeding behavior going into the season, but all this rain, did we lose some chicks this year? Are there going to be fewer young of the year birds when the hunting season rolls around?
That was certainly one of my concerns, because as you mentioned, we've had some very heavy rainfalls in local areas throughout the range. And so that is certainly something that we need to be thinking about. I have been in contact with quite a few folks that help with the rough grouse survey about their brood reports, and they have been reporting fairly decent numbers to date. This is just the very first part of June that they're reporting, but I was quite concerned, and so far I'm feeling fairly optimistic. But we do need to keep in mind that, as you mentioned, those real heavy rains, and we're getting more and more of those with climate change.
Right.
It does cause a lot of stress on those young birds that aren't quite feathered out, especially when they're real downy. They usually hatch around mid-June. And so that June period is particularly important for those young birds in terms of when we get those heavy rains and where they're occurring.
Another point I wanted to ask about are snow conditions. Now, this past winter, we didn't have much snow. The previous couple winters were tougher winters where you have snow, which is actually good for grouse, right? They can roost. They'll burrow right into the snow for thermal cover and to avoid predators. But this past winter, we didn't have as much snow. I would presume that would be bad for grouse, but we had great drumming counts, I guess, after the winter. Any thoughts on that dynamic?
Yeah, I wasn't sure what to expect either, but this is what my thoughts would be. We didn't have much snow, and so the birds were blending in with the ground cover pretty well. Mm-hmm. because they weren't dark birds on a white background, which is what they usually are when snow roosting conditions are terrible. Not only can they not benefit from diving under the snow and getting those thermal benefits of being in a snow roost, but they also get concealment benefits from predators because they're below the surface of the snow and they're not super visible on the white snow. But this year, a lot of the region didn't have any snow. And so the birds were not, dark birds on a white background, and the temperatures were very warm. So there wasn't that thermal cost of not being able to snow roost. So, in a typical Minnesota winter, we're below zero for a large portion of time. And that snow roosting allows them to conserve energy because they're able to maintain a temperature in their snow roost of about somewhere around 25 degrees or so. So it's quite a bit above ambient temperature when it's really cold. But this winter was so warm that it really wouldn't have been the benefit that it would have been in a colder winter.
Interesting. Okay. Well, bottom line, we had a lot of rough grouse going into the summer. We'll see how the chicks did and what it means for young of the year. It sounds like you're cautiously optimistic about that. You know, one thing I think it's worth pointing out to a general audience is that even a bad year in Minnesota, and this isn't going to be a bad year. This is going to be a good year, at least it sounds like. But even a bad year in Minnesota is better than most of the rest of the country for rough grouse hunting. I know a lot of people from out east, this is where they come to go grouse hunting because it's some of the best rough grouse opportunities in the country.
Absolutely. Minnesota is a very fantastic place for grouse hunting.
And we should point out quickly, the sharp-tailed grouse population looks like it's higher overall than last year, still down in that east central region, just not enough habitat really in east central Minnesota, it sounds like, to really provide the habitat that those birds need. But overall, better news than we've had in recent years for sharpies. Is that an accurate summary?
Yes. In the Northwest, the sharptails are doing very well. I know there's been a lot of habitat management going on in the Northwest that may be contributing to that. Also, we had a very warm winter, you know, that sharptails experienced as well. So that likely was very good for, you know, overwinter survival of sharptails in the Northwest. So numbers are looking very good in the Northwest. And in the East Central, you know, they're holding their own from last year. And so, you know, I think that's good news overall as well.
The season remains close in that East Central zone, correct?
Yes, correct. There were only 295 birds counted in that region this spring.
We'll focus on the good. Sounds like some solid opportunities for sharpies in the Northwest. And of course, great rough grouse hunting statewide in 2024 is the forecast. Charlotte, thanks a lot for joining me. Good to hear an upbeat report like this. And we'll look forward to seeing how it pays off this fall.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
You bet. That was Charlotte Roy from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources talking about the latest grouse reports from the spring surveys. You can read all about those in this week's print edition of Outdoor News. With that, let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Minnesota's largest outdoor event returns for its 43rd year, Game Fair. Check out dozens of hunting, fishing, and dog training seminars. Visitors can see more than 300 exhibitors, plus enjoy games for dogs and youth. Test the latest equipment and enjoy the world-famous duck and goose calling contest. Game Fair runs 2 weekends, rain or shine, August 9th, 10th, and 11th, and August 16th, 17th, and 18th at the Armstrong Ranch in Ramsey. See details at gamefair.com.
Fort Dodge, Iowa? Outdoor and entertainment adventures are awaiting you. Discover Iowa's largest off-highway vehicle park, Gypsum City OHV Park, with 60 miles of trails, mudding areas, tracks, and an obstacle course. The area also boasts water, paved mountain bike, and equestrian trails. Head into town to enjoy public art and studios, an orchard, aquatic center, and family entertainment venue. Fill up with excellent Korean cuisine, pizza, ice cream, craft beer, or local wines. For more information, visit DodgeTheOrdinary.com.
Attention hunters, are you ready to take your hunting game to the next level? OutdoorNews.com is your ultimate hunting partner. Stay up to date with the latest hunting trends, gear reviews, and expert tips from seasoned hunters. OutdoorNews.com provides the most comprehensive hunting news to ensure you're always in compliance with local laws. Whether you're a seasoned pro or a beginner, OutdoorNews.com is for you. We're passionate about preserving our hunting heritage and fostering responsible hunting practices. OutdoorNews.com, where hunters become legends.
Okoboji, Iowa has thousands of acres of lakes for fishing and public land for hunting, making it Iowa's best outdoor playground all year long. Start planning your next trip to Okoboji for fishing, hunting, swimming, or camping in one of our state parks. When you get off the water, enjoy our many locally owned restaurants and attractions, making Okoboji a favorite destination for your entire family. Plan your next trip at vacationokoboji.com. Okoboji, Iowa's best outdoor playground.
Chasen's Guide Service is your top option for Alaska's Kenai River salmon and trout fishing. If an Alaskan adventure is in your future, the Kenai River is essential to your experience, and to get the best river adventure, make it a day on the water with one of the experienced guides from Chasen's Guide Service. Chasen is already taking reservations for the summer of 2024, so visit chasensguideservice.com for more information. That's chasensguideservice.com.
Thinking about buying or selling rural real estate in Minnesota? Whitetail Properties Real Estate is the premier brokerage for buying or selling hunting land, farmland, and country homes. With local professionals and a national presence, no other brokerage can provide you with the same buying or selling experience as Whitetail Properties. To learn more about the current real estate market or connect with your local land specialist, stop by their booth at the upcoming Minnesota Deer and Turkey Classic or visit whitetailproperties.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Rob Dreisline with you for another segment. You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. I hope you like the broadcast. If you do, check us out online at outdoornews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to print or digital versions either via that website or via that phone number. It's that time of year when we start to think about dog training. Believe it or not, Game Fair is what, just less than a couple months away. We'll be talking about dogs jumping off docks. We'll talk about retrieving trials. And I thought maybe it's time to talk a little bit about dog training. And a gentleman has agreed to join us. I appreciate him carving out some time. His name is Pete Fisher, a very well-known name in dog training circles here in Minnesota. He's with Dogtra these days, dogtra.com, and he's going to spend a segment with us talking about summer dog training. Pete, good to see you. Thanks a lot for jumping into the broadcast.
Appreciate you having me on. It's been a few years.
Pete, technically, you're not supposed to be training dogs like on state-administered lands until July 15th, right? The idea is to keep the dogs from disrupting nesting activities. Is that right? But there's lots of private lands and ball fields, places like that. You can get out and run your dog right now.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, many opportunities. You just have to be careful so we don't get out and be disturbing duck nests, pheasant nests, things of that nature. But yeah, there's a lot of opportunities to work your dog without doing that.
Pete, tell us a little bit about your background. I remember when you were operating Fisher's Kennels, what, in that Albany area of kind of west central Minnesota. But you've been with Dogtra for quite a while now. Tell us about that transition in your career.
Well, yeah, that was a transition. I started the business, Fisher's Kennels and Hunt Club, longer ago than I can remember. But after 30 years, Rob, I had an opportunity to sell it to one of my assistants. And Craig Klein now owns the business. And I went to work for Dogtra Company, which is a remote training collar company. You know, back in the day, we used to call them shock collars, but e-collars, remote training collars, that's what we call them nowadays. And I actually work as a contractor for the company. So I help them design the product, test the product. Any major event that we might have some kind of representation at, I'm normally that person standing in a booth. Pheasant Fest, SHOT Show, Game Fair, those type of events. So it's a good gig for me. I always tell people, jack of all trade, master of none. So it's a good gig, and I enjoy what I do for them now.
And Pete, remote training collars have evolved a lot over the past several decades. I mean, in the early days, they kind of were shock collars, right? And I think some people who didn't know how to use them properly probably didn't do their dog a whole lot of good. But now if you follow the proper training protocols, I mean, you've been advocating for decades that you really think these are a great dog training tool, correct?
Correct. And you're going to find almost every professional gun dog, hunting dog trainer all across the United States uses a remote training collar. And basically, it's used to reinforce commands the dog already knows. Back in the day, they were one level and they were hot. And consequently, they got a bad reputation. Mm. But boy, have they come a long ways. As an example, the product that I use and work for Dogtra, you can dial the stimulation down to such a low level you can barely feel it through your nerve endings on your hand. And that's really what they work for, the way they operate. And what I always tell people is if you've ever gone to physical therapy or a chiropractor and they put a TENS machine on you, that's basically the same type of static stimulation that runs through your nerve endings and into your muscles. We've just figured out a way to correspond a transmitter and receiver with FM radio signal and apply the stimulation to reinforce commands at a distance.
You listen to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreisline. We're chatting with Pete Fisher a little bit. He's from Dogtra, dogtra.com, talking a little bit about e-collars and summer dog training. I'd like to get into that a little bit too. Pete, you're traditionally a lab man. You still own labs, you said, but you also have a GSP. You've worked with a lot of different hunting breeds over the years, but are you primarily a lab guy?
Correct. You know, when I was in business, Rob, I trained almost every breed, but as you're well aware of, the Labrador Retriever is king out in the field. And the reason being is just there's so many of them out there. You know, I think they finally got displaced this year by some other breed, but it's been the number one breed with the American Kennel Club for 25 years.
Have you seen, since the pandemic, more people owning dogs? I did a couple columns, Pete, where I talked to some folks at like some of the animal shelters who, during the pandemic, couldn't keep a dog in the place. As soon as a dog would come in, it found a home because a lot of people were working from home, a lot of more people working remotely. And they said, you know what? I think the place needs a dog. Is that consistent with what you've seen being in the canine industry, you might say?
Yes, very much so. And now we've actually kind of seen the flip side here in the past year or two, in that the shelters are starting to fill up again because people have had to go back to work. Mm-hmm. And so now it's kind of been a reverse of what we experienced during the pandemic. The other thing that I saw was the amount of indiscriminate breeding of breeds such as the Labrador Retriever.
Yes.
You know, there's just a whole host of genetic tests that we need to do on any breed, but especially the Labrador, which is my breed of choice. And there was just a lot of put two dogs together, and 63 days later, you'd get puppies, and they could sell them for $800-$900 during the pandemic. And quite honestly, nowadays, they're breeding those same dogs, and they can't barely sell them for a $100 bill. But everything runs in cycles, but we're seeing that. We saw that during the pandemic, and now we're seeing that change.
Pete, we're getting into a warmer weather pattern looking ahead. And in the past week, we certainly had some humid days. I've seen some 90s, maybe on the long range forecast. You need to be aware that you got to take care of your dog. You got to keep them cool. They're covered with fur. They get hot quickly, don't they? Any tips for dog training during the heat of summer? I presume, you know, get them out early and late in the day might be a good start, huh?
Yes. And stop if you can before that dog goes into heat stroke. That is one of the key parts of it. And sometimes you're not paying attention and that dog goes down with heat stroke before you even know it. And so the dog does not perspire to cool itself. It transfers the air in its lungs with cooler air that hopefully is outside. So if you've got 90 degree humid temperature outside, that makes it pretty difficult for that dog to transfer any heat through its lungs to dissipate the heat. The other thing you got to realize is people think, well, geez, I'll give them water work and that'll be a good way to cool it down. Take your dog out into one of these shallow ponds and work them sometime, Rob, during the middle of the summer. And that water in those ponds is pretty darn warm. So you just have to be very careful. Like you said, work early or work late, or just always stop before that dog would get to that critical point where it might go down on with heat stroke on you.
And it's important to remember, dogs can overheat even in the autumn, can't they? Even on a 55, 60 degree day or even cooler, right? You got to make sure you bring lots of water for your dogs this fall, too, because we've all seen dogs overheat. They don't know when to stop, some of them, do they? They live to run and flush birds.
Correct. I mean, that prey drive is something that we have refined and bred into these animals. And consequently, they don't know when it's time to stop. And so you, as the owner of that dog, you need to be aware of them, because most of the time when they go down on with heat stroke, it's almost too late because you need to get that dog to a vet fairly quick. You got to get them cooled down. And once they go into shock, it's almost too late and it's all over. There were so many dogs many years back in South Dakota. Do you remember that, Rob? Got to be maybe 15 years ago. And we had some really hot pheasant openers, and we had a fair amount of dogs that passed away.
Yep.
The other thing that came into play there, and a lot of people didn't realize it, but that's about the point where we found out that exercise-induced collapse was very prevalent in the Labrador breed. And we've now since identified the DNA gene for that. And a lot of these dogs were gone down from exercise-induced collapse, which is a hereditary defect, and it really wasn't heat stroke.
Pete, before we go, do you have some basic tips for someone who's they're getting ready to get their dog trained? Obviously, I hope they've been doing some training throughout the year, but where should a dog be right now in its training schedule if you're looking to have a successful pheasant opener or, you know, get out and chase some grouse? What should guys be doing right now? What are you doing?
My dogs get worked every day, but I also run them in what we call hunt tests. But I think you want to get that dog conditioned so he's in good physical shape. But a lot of it depends, Rob, on the age of the dog. So let's say if you got that new puppy here this spring and you're trying to get it ready, well, you've got to get the basics down. You've got to get that framework, that groundwork of obedience, the remote training collar conditioning, associated gun and birds. Those are all the things that you want to get instilled in a young dog before you take them in the field. And what I always tell people is, you didn't take your son or daughter out to their first baseball or softball game without practicing. If little Johnny was able to get a hit at his first time at bat, he wouldn't, if he hadn't been to practice, he wouldn't know to run to first base, second base, or the parking lot. So it's really important that we practice with the dog all summer long. And that way we've got a dog that's ready to go. We don't take them in the field if they're not broke to the gun. We don't have control over them with a remote training collar. And they've got to be exposed to some kind of bird. So those are kind of the basics that you want to start with a young dog.
Pete, before we go, if folks want to learn more about e-collar training, I presume there's tons of videos at dogchart.com. Is that a good place to start, or any other resources you would recommend?
We have quite a library on the dogchart.com website, and all you got to do is look under the support tab and you'll find them. And we've got lots of videos, lots of written information. If you don't want to watch videos, you want to read, much of it is put together by trainers with my help, and some of it's my information. And it's really, I think, the starting point where you have to be when you purchase a remote training collar. And it's always, you know, there's lots of people out there that did what I did for 30 years. There's still lots of trainers out there that are taking dogs for training. And even if you don't send the dog out for training, you could do some private lessons.
Excellent advice. Well, Pete, thanks for spending a segment with me. Maybe we'll check in with you a little later in the year as we get closer to the some of these game bird openers and lock in some precise tips for actually getting your dog afield and making sure everything goes well in the woods and waters and fields of Minnesota and across the region. But thanks for joining us. If folks want more information, again, dogchart.com. Have a good summer, Pete.
Thank you.
That's our friend Pete Fisher, dogchart.com. Appreciate him joining us. Let's take a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Looking for the perfect summer getaway? Look no further than Minnesota's own Lake of the Woods. Welcome to the walleye capital of the world, where the next hook set could be your personal best fish of a lifetime. But it's not just about the fishing. From cozy resorts to charming lodges, Lake of the Woods offers summer fun for everyone. Plus, our charters and expert fishing guides are ready to make your experience unforgettable. Discover the magic of Lake of the Woods. Visit lakeofthewoodsmn.com.
Minnesota's largest outdoor event returns for its 43rd year, Game Fair. Check out dozens of hunting, fishing, and dog training seminars. Visitors can see more than 300 exhibitors, plus enjoy games for dogs and youth. Test the latest equipment and enjoy the world-famous duck and goose calling contest. Game Fair runs 2 weekends, rain or shine, August 9th, 10th, and 11th, and August 16th, 17th, and 18th at the Armstrong Ranch in Ramsey. See details at gamefair.com.
Okoboji, Iowa has thousands of acres of lakes for fishing and public land for hunting, making it Iowa's best outdoor playground all year long. Start planning your next trip to Okoboji for fishing, hunting, swimming, or camping in one of our state parks. When you get off the water, enjoy our many locally owned restaurants and attractions, making Okoboji a favorite destination for your entire family. Plan your next trip at vacationokoboji.com. Okoboji, Iowa's best outdoor playground.
Ready for your next fishing adventure? Look no further than Lake City, Minnesota. Located in southeast Minnesota, nestled along the shores of Lake Pepin, this charming town offers some of the best fishing in the Midwest. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, Lake Pepin is teeming with walleye, bass, and more. And when you're not on the water, explore Lake City's quaint shops, delicious dining, and scenic beauty. Go to visitlakecity.org today and plan your trip to Lake City, Minnesota's South Shore.
Since 1967, Outdoor News has been Minnesota's go-to news source for all things out of doors. Generations of hunters and anglers have welcomed Outdoor News into their home each week, enjoying the most up-to-date news, features, columnists, fishing and hunting reports, gear reviews, and much, much more. For less than a dollar a week, you can join thousands of other Minnesota sportsmen and continue the long-standing tradition of subscribing to Outdoor News. Both print and digital versions are available. Start your subscription today at outdoornews.com/subscribe.
Great weather means it's time for kids to go out and play, but kids aren't the only ones outdoors. Ticks that spread Lyme disease and other infections are also active in the spring and summer. CDC reminds you and your children to wear insect repellent, bathe or shower as soon as possible after coming indoors, and check for ticks daily. If you've been bitten by a tick and develop fever, rash, or fatigue, seek medical care. To learn more, visit www.cdc.gov/Lyme.
Everybody, welcome back. Final segment of this week's broadcast of Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline, happy to be with you. Tim Lesmeister joining me. You can read us both in the print version of Outdoor News. You can subscribe to that by calling 800-535-5191 or visit our website, outdoornews.com. You can also subscribe to our digital versions there. Tim, welcome. It's good to see you. Thanks for joining me on this week's broadcast. You're up on Lake Superior, and we had a little story this week about a new decal that some trout and salmon folks are pushing up there to remind everybody how to properly identify those some of those species.
Well, in Minnesota waters, the steelhead is a fish that you have basically a zero limit on. You can't keep any of the steelhead, which is basically a lake-run rainbow trout. And they get real big. They're fun to catch. I'll tell you, whenever I hook into a steelhead, it is so much fun. It's like catching those monster rainbows up on the Kenai River up in Alaska. They jump, they run. But they don't, you know, look like the real colorful rainbows you find in the rivers. They tend to get a more silvery look. And so people get them confused with the coho salmon and the Chinook salmon. And so they decided to put out a sticker to show what the difference is between these fish. And I say, if anyone's planning on fishing on Lake Superior, you should have one of those stickers stuck somewhere in your boat. Because I think the best way to identify fish is through a visual, an illustration. I fish on the ocean a lot, and I have books and pamphlets and illustrations of all of the fish. So when I catch one, I can figure out quickly what it is.
Now, I haven't fished a ton on Lake Superior. I've fished steelhead a number of times, and I feel like I'm pretty good at a spot identifying these fish. But, I mean, sometimes, you know, those lake-run steelhead can look really silver. They can look a lot like a coho. And to the untrained person, it's challenging to identify these different species.
Yeah, again, unless you've been on the lake a lot like I have, sure. Of course, I can look at what comes into the boat and immediately tell you exactly what it is. But I agree. You know, there are people that, you know, aren't real well-versed, haven't fished the lake as much, just getting started on Superior. You know, had a couple of downriggers out, some boards, and maybe a long line, and picked up a steelhead along the way. Well, you know what it is. You got to let that fish go.
Tim, I wrote my column a little bit about a national topic. I can't remember if you and I spoke about this spotted owl situation out in the Pacific Northwest. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has unveiled a massive plan, potentially spending close to $250 million over 30 years to shoot barred owls so that they don't interbreed or they don't displace spotted owls in that part of the country. Barred owls are a native species, very common. Anyone who's been out in the turkey woods in the spring has probably heard a barred owl multiple times, very distinctive. But their range has expanded west, and combined with the loss of old-growth timber in that part of the world, spotted owls are in trouble, and the feds are basically saying if we don't shoot barred owls, we're going to lose spotted owls. So it's kind of a tough one. What do you make of it?
Well, this isn't the first time the spotted owl has been on the radar, and there's been, you know, development in areas where the spotted owl has been prevalent, and they didn't want to do that.
A lot of logging, exactly.
And so, you know, the spotted owl has always been on the cusp. Is it going to make it? Is it not going to make it? Maybe we're at the point in our, short history of man where we just say, because of us, we have destroyed so much habitat, moved so many animals, disjointed the whole ecosystem to the point where we might lose the spotted owl. Is it worth killing mass quantities of barred owls to, you know, save a species that's going to go away anyway? You know, and who knows, maybe the spotted owl will figure out that they have to expand their range, fare better than we think they would. So who knows? I think we, killing barred owls, I just don't think it's the answer.
What did you make of my logic, Tim, that, you know, I'm all for the annihilation of exotic species, especially ones that humans have brought here, especially ones we're responsible for, including feral cats and house sparrows and starlings. But this is a species that has expanded its range. It's native to North America, expanded its range fair and square. And then you get around to the question, will it even work? You know, you're going to spend $250 million. Will this even work? Because, you know, Outdoor News Radio has learned that birds fly. And if you shoot a bunch of barred owls out there, won't new ones just come in? I mean, nature abhors a vacuum kind of thing. This is a lot of money. You could go build a new national wildlife refuge with $250 million.
That's what struck me about your column, is that they're spending an incredible amount of money here for something that probably won't work.
Could you do it in some localized areas at a much more affordable rate? Is this the sort of thing you could, I don't know, it would seem like you could find some nonprofit partners to work with you on this, but I don't know who that is, right? Who's willing to go out and shoot barred owls? It's not your Audubon guys, right?
No, exactly. I mean, you know how you're going to even open a season on them, you'll probably get two licenses sold.
Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreesen and Tim Lesmeister bringing this week's broadcast home. Another Western story, Tim, that broke, I believe it was July 5th I heard about it. There was a shooting out at the Canyon Village in Yellowstone National Park. I've been out there. I've stayed in that area once. My parents get out there at least every other year, so they're very familiar with it. There was a shooting, which in and of itself, there's a lot of shootings in the United States, and you hate to see it in a national park. I believe the only person who died was the guy with the gun. I think a ranger was in the hospital. But the rest of the story kind of struck me as interesting. The feds went in there, the FBI went in there, and this didn't get a lot of publicity, but they like emptied the lodging in that area 2 days later. And it almost got me wondering, what's going on? Is this a bigger story? Were there other motives here, you know, that we're not understanding? And I want to be careful with supposition, but when you're talking about, hundreds and hundreds of people having their vacation interrupted when it sounded like a lone gunman, any impressions, Tim?
Here's the problem with a situation like this, is that when they're being secretive, when they bring in the feds,
right, the FBI,
when they shut this place down, it brings out all of these conspiracy theorists, and it gets me thinking too, and I don't want to be one of those people, that think that there's something ulterior going on here, and there's some deep, dark secrets that are being held back. So I hope that we find out what's going on here, because it does seem very, very strange.
And finally, Tim, a story that broke after our print deadline, we got it at OutdoorNews.com this past Wednesday. The U.S. Forest Service earlier in the year had some document, Frequently Asked Questions, where they talked about the leash law and how dogs have to be on a leash, 6-foot leash at all times. And, some sporting groups, Sportsmen for the Boundary Waters and others, were like, wait a minute, we go up there and we grouse hunt and we duck hunt. I can't keep my dog on a leash under those circumstances. The feds on Wednesday issued a notice making it very clear that you can hunt, use your dog off leash for hunting. They're not going to ticket anybody. But they do seem like they're sticking to their guns that pretty much all of the times dogs have to be on a 6-foot leash up there, other than maybe when they're in a canoe.
I don't get it, because I think 6-foot leash is very short. That's a leash that you use to walk your dog. That's a leash that you use to keep your dog on heel. And to have your dog on a 6-foot leash in your campground, in your campsite, doesn't make any sense. And here's why. I'm sure you're worried that the dog is going to take off and go chase animals, and I would be too. But they make these things you can screw into the ground that have cables that are 8-foot, 10-foot, 12-foot, even 20 feet. And I think that those would be more than adequate to keep your dog in your campsite region. A 6-foot leash makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah, I encourage folks to go to OutdoorNews.com and read that whole story. We'll probably see some more backlash fallout to that in coming weeks and months. Well, Tim, good luck up there on Lake Superior. Hope the fishing continues to hold up for you, and have a good week ahead.
Boy, I do too. I'm going to get into the bay now that it's clearing up and try and get some of those big smallmouth bass. I'll let you know next week if those are have moved out and are starting to snap some baits.
Sounds good. Thanks. That's our buddy Tim Lesmeister. With that, we're out of time. Everybody have a great week out of doors. Rob Jerusalem signing off for Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.